music session number 11754, Rule 5.
Smith, Reel 5.
All 12 bombs went through the wall in an ascending line from right to left, which reflected the formation pattern flare and the bombing techniques and tactics used. The holes had all been repaired, and you could see clearly the repair was clearly visible in new brick, and each hole was something like 3 or 4 feet diameter, if not more. I didn't want to hang around the wall of the prison too much or take too great an interest in it. I really want to look on the inside and see what had happened and where the bombs had exploded and what the damage and effect had been and whether we had got the technique right. But I didn't dare do it, as I was in civilian clothes, and thought I'd better clear out before I was arrested by the French on suspicion. And that, I think, is about it.
When you were briefed on the raid, on its objective, how was the objective put to you in terms of its importance?
The reason for the raid was given as there were members or a member of the resistance imprisoned in Yamyung prison. The Germans didn't know who he was or how important he was. And he was due to be executed for, along with some others, for some other reason that was unclear. And it was vitally important that they be sprung before the Germans knew who he was, because if they knew who he was, they could extract from him an awful lot of information they wouldn't otherwise be able to get.
What did you think about the demands for accuracy that were placed upon the airmen?
They were normal. There were nothing. There was no abnormal demand. When you're doing these low-level precision things, you have to be very, very precise and very, very accurate, both as to time, heights, speeds, angles, positions, the lot. And it's well within anyone's competence to achieve these levels. It was my business as a squadron commander to see that I had people who could. It was interesting to know that of this squadron, 487 squadron, I'd only been command of it a little over a fortnight when I did this job. And I flew with everyone, those pilots in that squadron. The first thing I did, see what they liked. And the man I selected for this, to fly this, this particular target, were not the two flight commanders, it was Gordon, but a flight lieutenant to lead the second section. My number two was a pilot officer, New Zealander. My number three was a sergeant, an English sergeant. The two in the second section with the flight lieutenant were both pilot officers. all very junior men, inexperienced, but all men I judge to have the necessary degree of skill and ability to do this job. And this is what being a squadron commander is. No good just saying you, sure, our name's out of a hat, you select people for the job.
You don't go just by seniority?
No, not at all. Abilities, everything.
Any other intruder raids that you carried out in these days that we can recall in detail?
Not a lot. We did some reprisal things that one doesn't blazing around. We had one I recall is after the invasion was we had a direct link, radio link with the Special Air Service, and they reported that a Canadian platoon had been captured and beaten to death in a small village in Brittany by an SS unit, and the SAS thought it would be a very good thing if we could go, someone could come down and duff these chaps up a bit. So he said, all right, when can we catch them with their pants down? When do they eat? What are their domestic arrangements? And we got this information back, and so we went down at dusk and attacked these buildings that they occupied. And I must say, these chaps were pretty bold. They had them standing up in the street in shop doorways, shooting with automatic weapons. See them doing it. Anyhow, we put paid to this chap. We killed something like over 140 of them, which did everyone's morale a great deal of good, and this sort of thing didn't occur again throughout the Normandy campaign. So that was, it's not an attractive thing to do. It was a sort of thing that happens in wartime and that you must do, and I think it had unseen, or could have had unseen, beneficial effects on prisoners on both sides. They're always very vulnerable. That's one. We had an excellent one where we did a big barracks at Poitiers.
Where's that?
Poitiers, down below the Loire. There was a division, armoured division, coming up from south of France to reinforce, this is a German, reinforce Germans in the beachhead. And they paused overnight in a barracks and had all their soft vehicles, soft skin transport there. And we managed to, all three squadrons on the wing did this, and we managed to inflict a great deal of damage on this armored division. And we know they were never again a cohesive force, because they arrived, instead of arriving in the beachhead as a fighting unit, they arrived in dribs and drabs as reinforcements, individual reinforcements. So that was a good result. We did various radar stations in German initially. We did a lot of if we weren't involved by day, we operated at night. Night interdiction, and you flew all sorts of targets, primary and secondary targets. If you couldn't find anything somewhere, you then went on somewhere else to try and find something. And if there was nothing, then you would drop your bombs on a German headquarters at 1 minute intervals on the seconds, sort of. You wake everyone up and they don't get any sleep. And there was one particular night, I think it was just before the breakout, and the main German headquarters, we wanted to keep awake, and it was dreadful weather, and so we flew all night, flew three sorties each at night, and we dropped a bomb on that headquarters on the minute, every minute, all night, one single bomb, as near as we could land it on. We had a bomb on G, since we were in cloud. Actually, apart from G, you didn't know where you were. But we captured some of these people afterwards, and I was particularly interested to know this. I went out of my way to discover if this was any use at all. You know, it could have been a complete waste of effort. They said, yes, it was. I kept awake all night, and they were absolutely dead tired. Never knew when the next one was coming, except the minute was nearly up, you know. Bang. This knocks their efficiency down enormously when people get so tired.
Did you find that the German fighter opposition by now was very weak?
Didn't see a fighter, ever. I didn't see... After middle of 1942, I didn't see another German aeroplane.
As early as that?
Yeah, anywhere.
And the German flak in 1945 in France?
German flak was very, very efficient and very dangerous. Basil Embry wanted to give you a couple of instances. Basil Embry wanted to see if we could attack targets in the Pas-de-Calais. And so he rang me up and said, would I take my squadron and see if this is on? And I said, no, I very well wouldn't. I'd go myself if he insisted on it, but I'd take one other chap so that he, with a bit of luck, he'd know what happened to me, but I wouldn't take a whole squadron in there, do what he wanted to do. I thought it was crazy because you couldn't take the volume of flak that you got there in mosquitoes. Mosquitoes were vulnerable to damage. Being a wooden aeroplane and the method of construction, while they were cheap to build, if you got anything through the main spar, then the whole wing had to come out and a new wing put in. And the wing is built as one piece from one wing tip to the other wing tip. And the fuselage was built in as a tube, and then it was piece cut out of it like that, and it was fitted over the top of the wing, and the whole thing bolted together. And it was quite good on damage from the point of view of keeping it flying, damage and one thing and another, but you couldn't then put it back in the air again once you got it back if you had a thing like a duck through your main spar or something. For example, we couldn't fly anywhere from the from Belgium, Holland, right round the Frisian Islands, from October onwards, because of the wildflower, the ducks and volume of ducks and geese made it quite impossible. You couldn't take the damage that you got from the birds. And this is at low level. Now, equally, you couldn't take the volume of flak you could get, which was all 20 millimetre, you got in the power to carry. And cut a long story short, I went to, with another man, flies my number two, to attack this particular target. And I said, I wouldn't fly in low level, I'll fly at the self-destruct level of the 20 millimeter flak, which if you know it and you've had enough flak, you can ride the flak. And and I took a new navigator. I mean, I had done 120 trips in the Middle East, and see what he'd like. And I always used to write my flight plan indelible ink on my back of my hand, so that didn't matter what happened, all I had to look at, if I could see the back of my hand, I had it. And this chap went rigid, and he'd never seen anything like it when he saw the sort of stuff you had coming at you. And eventually we got to the target, and the Germans were shooting with 88s on the ground. And the 88s had proximity fuses, and they were bursting at ground level and amongst the trees and the branches of trees coming off and flak. Had great explosions all over the place. And cut a long story short, I missed the target, missing the flak, missing these trees and one thing and another, you see. And came back and said, it's not very well on. And wheeled out one stiff navigator and sent him off on a rest, you know, and said, well, this is what's like, lad, you know. And so we didn't do that again. Another one he wanted was to, if we could bomb with oboe. And so he borrowed two oboe-equipped aeroplanes from Bomber Command and flew at a tight formation on them, and to bomb a target in Le Havre. Did this on a beautiful, sunny, clear day, and it required a 20-mile dead straight and level run. This gave the German gunners time to get it absolutely computed correctly, and they absolutely had it, and they damaged 9 of my 12 aeroplanes bombing this target, and all those aeroplanes had to be replaced. Now, this is, you can't accept this sort of damage at any time, that rate of damage. You soon run out of aeroplanes. because man hours and involved in replacing them and rebuilding them and repairing them becomes absolutely horrendous. And so therefore these two types of targets were unacceptable. These sort of mosquitoes, this sort of attack, by reason of the efficiency of the German gunners. And they really were efficient. They had, I reckon they had the mosquito absolutely to sights. They had some sort of rote or rule or adaptation to their gun sights that they could get the deflection right, because they were invariably hit in the center section. Never towards the tail, rarely. Never anywhere except in the center section, where the most vulnerable. Where the crew was, where all the fuel was, where all the control centered, you name it, it's all there. And I thought they were excellent. And I had great respect for them. Remember one man we called Hans Schmidt. He sat in a barn. He went in and out of on all these what they're called noble, the V1 sites. They're called noble targets. It's the code name for them. And we went in and out just south of Dieppe, and one little nick in the cliffs there was easily identifiable from the sea when you're a low level. Day in, day out, streams of mosquitoes going in like this and roaming around. And after a little while, a chap was put in a little barn on this route with a machine gun and used to shoot at you. He never shot anyone or got anywhere near anyone. I don't think he's trying, actually. And the Germans started to dig gun pits along there, you see. And so we watched all this with interest. And I was shot up by my number two. So a bit of bad discipline on his part. And he succeeded in shooting out an engine on my aeroplane. And I couldn't feather it. So I was sitting there with an engine I couldn't feather, no instruments on it, in a very sad state. And I was very vulnerable, because with an unfeathered and non-operating engine, you've got an awful lot of drag. And my route out, I was going to go right past Hans Schmidt, so I wasn't prepared to give him a sitting duck shot, so I shot him, or sod, in his barn, deliberately went out of my way, gave him a squirt, and this is what survival's all about.
This is the name you invented for
him? Yes, Hans Schmidt. Whoever he was, he had his troops that day. And if you don't do these things, you don't survive. And at least I think not. I'm here to prove it, truly. And so that's the sort of, whether those are amusing little anecdotes or not, I don't know.